Well, tonight, brothers and sisters, as you've already been told, of course, it's Zephaniah. He's about here. Now, just remember, of course, that we've had four nights on the individual prophets. We had a look at Hosea and Amos, who had prophesied, of course, near the end of the kingdom of Israel in the north, the ten-tribe kingdom. We had a look at Micah, who's back here somewhat in Judah. Where is he? Can't find over here, sorry. Micah, who was a contemporary with Isaiah. And tonight we come further up in history to have a look at Zephaniah. Now you'll notice from that we're not dealing with the prophets in chronological order, but we're dealing with them as, of course, we see fit, and to bring out the message of each individual prophet. Now he had an interesting era in which to prophesy, did Zephaniah. And fortunately, brethren and sisters, we do have a date for his prophecy, as we read in that first chapter in verse 1, that the word of Yahweh which came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hizkiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah. Rather unusual, you know, for a prophet to introduce himself going back three or four generations. One wonders why he did that. Actually, the last one mentioned is Hezekiah. And one wonders whether there's some relationship there that is not revealed in the Word. But whatever it was, brothers and sisters, Zephaniah is telling us that he has genealogies just stretching back over these evil years preceding Josiah in the years of Manasseh and Ammon. Now that's important. So we've got Zephaniah pinpointed in history in the years of one king, Josiah. And he came at a time, brethren and sisters, when there was in operation one of the greatest reformations in the history of Judah. But you'd never read about that in that book. You'd never dream that when that man wrote those words, that the ecclesial halls in the days of Zephaniah were packed full of people. But you wouldn't believe it when you read those words, would you? And you've got to go back in history to see the reason why Zephaniah speaks like he did. You see, Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, a wonderful king Hezekiah, but his son did not continue, brethren and sisters, that goodness of his reign. Manasseh had the longest reign of any king of Judah or Israel, for that matter. He reigned for 55 terrible years. 55 awful years did Manasseh reign. And his was not only a reign of wickedness, brothers and sisters, but he was a great organizer. And whereas other kings were flippant, apathetic, and downright evil, this man was all of those things, but he added to that his ability to organize. And you know something? So well did he organize iniquity in his day that from his time, Yahweh determined, long before the end of the kingdom of Judah here in Zedekiah, Yahweh determined the end of that kingdom. Right back in his day, Yahweh says, no way will they change. And they didn't. And Manasseh set a pattern which no king could change, not even Josiah. So well did he organize the iniquity of his day, did Manasseh. 55 years he reigned. His son Amnon, he only reigned 2 years. But that meant there were 57 years, brethren and sisters, of evil reign. And I'll tell you something else. They were 57 years without a Bible. Because Josiah found one. And it became almost a sensation that they had a Bible after 57 years. He found one in the rubbish of the temple. Such was the awful reign of Amon and of Manasseh before him. And Josiah, of course, came upon the scene and he tried to alter all that. Now the history of the times is in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 34. And this sets the background, along with the words of Jeremiah, for the prophecy of Zephaniah. Here we have the history of the times of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah. And we read in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 34, but Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 130 years. 8 years old. 2 Chronicles 34 verse 1. 8 years old he was. Obviously, brethren and sisters, he was under guidance during those early years. And we read in verse 2, and he did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh, and walked in the ways of David his father, and declined neither to the right hand or the left. For in the 8th year of his reign, while he was yet young, 16 years old, while he was 16 years old, he began to seek after God, the God of David his father. 16! Now I'd like them just to pause here, brethren and sisters, and make a point for our 16-year-olders. Here's a man that the record of Scripture says began to seek God, the God of David, his father. Now, what does that mean? He wasn't a boy who, at the age of 16, had some vague idea that there was a God and went to seek him. But he was a boy who had been indelibly impressed with the heroes of the past. He sought the God of David, his father. He'd read about the life of David. He'd heard about the life of David. There were histories of the book of the life of David, extant. There were about four prophets who wrote concerning the life of David. They had books about this hero of faith. And this young fellow, 16 years of age, was fired by that example. I wished we had some 16-year-olders like him. And if you think, brethren and sisters and young men in this audience, that that was a phenomenon of ancient times, Brother Roberts had read Elpis Israel, the whole of it, at 14 years of age. That's bringing it a bit closer home. How many of that age in this ecclesia have read Elpis Israel all the way through? And he was fired by the example of Dr. Thomas who went before him. And if ever we need that, we need it today. Oh boy, I tell you what, if this generation goes on, brethren and sisters, if time is extended and we don't know what's going to happen, but if it is, whatever is going to happen to the next generation, I know not. Because we don't see today 16-year-olders fired up by the example of the past. But here was one who was, and he sought God, the God of David, his father. And he looked back beyond the days of his own father and his grandfather, right back to the days of David. And he drew inspiration from other men who were moved by the power of the word at the age of 16. And so impressed was he in seeking after that God that he acted upon it 4 years later. It took him 4 years, and we read in the 12th year of his reign, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves and the carved images and the molten images. 20-year-old boy sets out on a course of life to lead the whole nation against what the world had entrenched in the ecclesia. He sent, brethren and sisters, he set out to turn the world upside down. 20-year-old boy. And he was highly successful as far as his own personal endeavors were concerned. He was not successful with the people, though he might have thought that he was. You know, over in chapters, verses 30 and 32, when he was then 26, we read this in verse 30. And the king went up into the house of Yahweh, and the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the priests and the Levites, and all the people, great and small. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant that was found in the house of Yahweh. And the king stood in his place and made a covenant before Yahweh to walk after Yahweh, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of the covenant which are written in this book. And he caused all that were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin to stand to it. And you can see him up there, brethren and sisters, 26 years of age. And he goes to the house of Yahweh, and they had a pillar in that house. There was a pillar set there, a royal pillar. And he stood alongside that pillar. Whoever stood there was leader of the day. And he stood there in his rightful place. And he, as leader of the people, he bowed unto Yahweh that with all his heart and soul he would serve him. And then he made all the people to stand to it. Didn't say that they did it with all their heart and soul, because they didn't. But such was the burning zeal of this young man that no one dared to brook his commandments. And he did cause them to stand to it. And all of that happened from the 12th year of his reign. And so we look into the days of Josiah, and you see people streaming up to the temple. There are fires burning all over the land. As he burnt every idol he could lay his hands on, he even dug up men's graves and burnt their bones upon the altars, the false altars which they had set up to worship. He burnt everything. There never was a purge like that. The land was clean. The temple was filled from the 12th year of that man onwards. And everybody would have thought, looking on, that it was a wonderful era in Israel's history. But Zephaniah could see further than that, brothers and sisters. It was all a big facade. It was all a big front. It was all useless. And we learn that from Jeremiah. Look at the first chapter of Jeremiah. And this was the back. This was what was going on in the hearts and the minds of the people. Because Jeremiah also prophesied from the time of Josiah. And it's rather significant, brethren and sisters, when you read the first chapter of Jeremiah, In the first two verses of Jeremiah chapter 1, we read, "The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests that were in Anathoth, in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of Yahweh came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign." In the 13th year of his reign. And we've just read in Chronicles that in the 12th year of his reign, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem. And along comes Jeremiah, and he's in the middle of a reformation. He's at the very start of the reformation. People are being galvanized into action. But you see, brethren and sisters, it was all a facade. Underneath, they were rotten to the core. They'd never forgotten the days of Manasseh. And people were going along to the meetings because it was the right thing to do, and if you didn't go, you got criticized. And no one wanted to suffer criticism. And so it was the right thing to do to go to the meeting. But what about your heart and mind that has nothing to do with it? And today, brethren and sisters, there's a great danger of that. Are we here at the class? Because Sunday morning I said we ought to be at the Bible class. Is that why we're here? Well, perhaps we are, and we might be because, for a good reason. Maybe we've taken heart of the exhortation. But are we afraid to be criticized? Is that why we're here? What are you thinking about now? What's your left home? What's he going to do in the mind? Is that what's in your mind? Is that why we're here, brothers and sisters? Well, Jeremiah stood there in the 13th year of his reign, and this is what he saw in his third chapter. This is what he said concerning the worship of Judah in that day. And in chapter 3 and verse 10, Jeremiah says, "And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith Yahweh." In the margin, in falsehood. He doesn't say they hadn't turned to him, brothers and sisters, because ostensibly they had. And there they were, packing the temple. But he says they've only done it in falsehood. But it would, all appearances, would be a wonderful reformation. You turn up to the 7th chapter of Jeremiah. And you read the words of the prophet here. Verse 1 of the 7th chapter, when Yahweh says to him, that the word that came to Jeremiah from Yahweh saying, "Stand in the gate of Yahweh's house and proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of Yahweh, all ye of Judah that enter in at these gates to worship Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh of armies, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust ye not in lying words saying, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh are these." See the point, brethren and sisters? You imagine, you know, we read this and we think, oh, well, you know, it's another story. It's altogether different today. What if you were asked to stand at that door Sunday morning, stand right at that door and just say Yahweh's words there, everybody that comes to it, you say, you're a hypocrite. Sister so-and-so, you're a hypocrite. Brother so-and-so, you're an absolute hypocrite. How'd you like to hear that? They were real people that did this, brethren and sisters. It was a real issue, and they were packing into that temple. And as they came along, as Jeremiah points out, the custom was, they were so caught up with this worship, that is ostensibly, they were so impressed with the externals of their worship, they were linking arms and singing, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh are we. And he says, you're hypocrites. Amend your ways and your doings. Never mind about packing into this place. And he stood, brethren and sisters, in the court of the temple to do that. And that's what the people were doing in the days of Josiah. That's what they're doing 12 months after his reformation got underway. That's what the prophet Jeremiah was talking to them. And Zephaniah was a contemporary with all that. And how long did it go on for? Turn over to the 25th chapter of Jeremiah, brothers and sisters. It went right through to the end of the kingdom. It never changed. And in Jeremiah 25 and verse 3, we read, "From the 13th year of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, even unto this day, that is the 23rd year, the word of Yahweh hath come unto me, and I have spoken unto you, rising early and speaking, but ye have not hearkened." Now that's interesting, isn't it? There he were, it was, in the 13th year of his reign. He reigned 31 years, and for 23 years, they never changed. And those years, brethren and sisters, carried them right through to the end of the kingdom. A little bit before the end of the kingdom. There were a few years to go on the end of Josiah. 3 months, 11 years, 3 months, 11 years, and it was all over. It was all over. And they never changed in all that time. And yet they had that wonderful man, Josiah, behind them, urging them on to do the right thing in the sight of God. No way could he change their heart and mind. That was fixed long ago through the work of Manasseh. You know, brethren and sisters, it's frightening, really, when you think about the judgments of Yahweh. You know, we talk about doing things. Maybe it's too late to do anything, we say. Maybe it is. And it just only goes to illustrate, brethren and sisters, the urgency of the days in which we live. These are urgent days. Jesus Christ is going to stand in this earth and it's all over. So quick that it come. 3 months, 11 years, 3 months, 11 years, gone. And Zephaniah was right. The day of Yahweh, speeding along, he said. He was speeding along, all right. And they listened to his words and the words of Jeremiah all over that time. And they never altered. Yahweh said, I sent me prophets. I got them to rise up early and send them in late. They never without a prophet. A prophet hadn't perished out of Jerusalem. He kept warning them, and they never listened. And you know, you wonder, brothers and sisters, you really wonder. I don't set myself up as a paragon of righteousness, but I'll tell you what, I've told certain brethren certain things, and they've said, yes, 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 and they do exactly the opposite. And they pay dearly for what they do. And I'm no prophet, I only read the Bible. And people say, yes, 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 and they don't do a mortal thing about it. But the day of Yahweh is speeding along. And who knows how many years we got, if years, maybe months or weeks, and that is no exaggeration, brothers and sisters. There's a mighty climax building up. And Zephaniah could see it, Jeremiah could see it, but nobody else could. And you know, Josiah was so stirred up by the Bible that he found. And I believe that there is abundant evidence in his own prophecy to illustrate that all they found was Deuteronomy. The book of the law that Moses had written out and put alongside the altar, alongside the ark rather, in the most holy, I believe that all he found was Deuteronomy. There's abundant allusions to Deuteronomy. Matter of fact, there's only one allusion outside of it in his prophecy. So he only found Deuteronomy, but that stirred that young man to his soul. And he tried to get the people to stand to what was written in that book. And look what was written in that book. Oh boy, all the blessings were there and all the cursings were there, brethren and sisters, all of them. All the cursings were in that book. And there are specific curses spelt out in the book of Deuteronomy in one section. 12 of them. As if there's one for a tribe. And they're all spelled out there. And the king was horrified when he read it. As he realized the awesomeness of Yahweh and what was coming. So much so that when we come back to the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 34, that he sought some information about the condition of the nation, what they could do about it. And there was a prophetess in the nation, brethren and sisters. A prophetess. There wasn't any man that he could go to. We read in verse 22, and Hilkiah and they that the king had appointed went to Huldah the prophetess, the wife of Shallum the son of Tikbah, the son of Hasrah, keeper of the wardrobe, and she dwelt in Jerusalem in the college. And they spake to her of that effect. And they ask her opinion. And verses 26 and 28, she says this. And as for the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of Yahweh, so shall ye say unto him, thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, concerning the words which thou hast heard, because thine heart was tender, and thou didst humble thyself before God, when thou heardst his words against this place, and against the inhabitants thereof, and humblest thyself before me, and didst rend thy clothes and weep before me, I have even heard thee also, saith Yahweh. Behold, I will gather thee to thy fathers, and thou shalt be gathered to thy grave in peace. Neither shall thine eyes see all the evil that I will bring upon this place and upon the inhabitants of the same. So they brought the king word again. You know, those words, brothers and sisters, are full of drama. You know, you want to know the realism of that Bible. You know, here's a young man and he sends off for a message from Yahweh. What's the message saying? Too late. He's in the middle of the reform. Too late. 57 years too late. There's nothing, Josiah, nothing's going to change this people. But I'm going to look after you. And that, brethren and sisters, is a comfort and a consolation. I'll tell you something. It's long, long overdue. It's too late for this world. The Christadelphians won't convert the world. No way in the wide world we do that. No good giving a charity or joining the Salvation Army and beating a timbrel. You won't save the world, brothers and sisters. But you might save yourself. And that's what Josiah was told. Young and tender-hearted, humble, brothers and sisters. What commendation is that? Show me a young man, tender-hearted and humble, today. A young man, tender-hearted and humble, What incredible virtues in a young man. Those sort of things you see sometimes in women and sometimes in old men. We saw them in young men, but that's what he was, tender and humble. And Yahweh says, I'll look after you. And he did. He got him killed on the field of battle. He was killed on the plain of Megiddo, the valley of Jezreel. Killed there. And that was Yahweh's mercy, brothers and sisters. Took him out of the way. Got himself involved in a fight that didn't belong to him. And got killed. But that was mercy. And when you see what happened to his children, my word, that was mercy. And you know, his children suffered. In Zephaniah chapter 1, you read about them. You see that Zephaniah clearly implies that the king was exempt from judgment, but not his children. And in Zephaniah chapter 1 and at verse 8, we read, and it shall come to pass in the day of Yahweh's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. And notice, brethren and sisters, that Zephaniah is careful to exclude the king. He doesn't say, I will punish the king, I will punish the king's children. And look at this. Four of the last kings, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, three of those four last kings were his sons. Jehoahaz was his son. Jehoiakim was his son. And Zedekiah was his son. His immediate children. Jehoiachin was his grandson. But the other three were his own sons. I will punish the king's children. The king didn't even convert his own family. Such was the effect of the evil days. And you know, brethren and sisters, I suppose that there will be at the judgment seat many mums and dads that will be in the kingdom of God. And in all probability, not all their children. Because whatever people may do, such is the iniquity of this world, brethren and sisters, such is the indelible impressions made upon young minds today, that it's going to take every fibre of our being to get our children into the kingdom of God, let alone ourselves. And we can't be sure of ourselves. But those of us who have grown up in the truth and are still with it and still love the truth are going to have an almighty job to get our children into the kingdom of God. They may come to the waters of baptism and they might pass through one after the other, after the other, after the other. But what are they doing once they've gone through the waters of baptism? Where is the 16-year-old boy at Enfield seeking the God of the heroes of the past? Where is he? Why isn't he there? Because the world has made such an indelible impression that it's so difficult to get a young man to relinquish that, to read the Bible. And poor old Josiah did it, and all he had was Deuteronomy. And he was absolutely thunderstruck by its contents. Now that's the message of Zephaniah. He would save himself and not even his children. Three of his sons succeeded him, and all went the way of flesh, brethren and sisters, the lot of them, including his grandson Jehoiachin. And that is a tremendous exhortation. You know, even Zephaniah himself, his very name would indicate that there is a message in this book, but it's up to each individual personally to escape the wrath that is coming. You see, in verse chapter 2, for example, in verse 3, seek Yahweh, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be, says Yahweh, that ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger. And Zephaniah means whom Yahweh hath hidden. That's the very meaning of his name. Whom Yahweh hath hidden. It may be that ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger. And you know, brethren and sisters, that's a wonderful expression, isn't it? Hidden from the day of Yahweh's anger. You know, Isaiah 26, come into thy chambers, shut thy doors about thee until the judgments overflow. And you see the angels going forth into the earth to reap the great harvest of faith and to bring brothers and sisters of faith together and to hide them in the shadow of God's hand as he breathes out his wrath upon this world, and a wrath such as the world has never seen, brethren and sisters. And the name of Yahweh shall come from far, says the prophet, and his anger burning in his anger. And people who have loved God, hidden from that wrath, in the shadow of his hand. It might be, says Zephaniah, that you shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger. Who would be hid? The meek of the earth. And there weren't too many of them. Jeremiah, who was a contemporary of this prophet, was told to run through the streets of Jerusalem. God says, run through the streets of Jerusalem. Find me one man that's serving me properly. And the streets were full of worshippers. He said, I want you to find me one. And that was the condemnation upon that generation, brethren and sisters. And we're no different from them as far as our physical constitutions are concerned. What a message that is. Now, Zephaniah's prophecy is divided up very broadly, and I say broadly like this, because the purpose of these evenings is only given an overview of the prophecy. Divided up like that. Chapter 1 and verse 1 to chapter 2 verse 3 is the coming judgment upon Judah. From chapter 2 verses 4 to 15 we have a section on judgment on the Gentiles. Chapter 3 verses 1 to 7 is Yahweh's judgment is justified. And then from chapter 3 verses 8 to 20 we have this final message of hope. Now that's how the prophecy of Zephaniah is very broadly divided up. And it's fairly straightforward when you look at the words. There's nothing very difficult about that. It's fairly straightforward the way the prophecy is broken up. Let's have a brief look at that first section, brethren and sisters. The judgment that was coming upon Judah. Why was it coming upon Judah? Well, he gives a whole lot of reasons in verse 1. In verse 4, he says, I will stretch out my hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place. Now we've got to realize that the word Baal here is in the plural. I will cut off the remnant of Baals in this place. And we've made this point time and again, brethren and sisters. Baal doesn't simply mean Lord. Baal has a much stronger meaning even than that. It means a possessor. And because of which it's often used to describe a husband who's made one, of course, with his wife and possesses her in that sense. So Baal means someone who's got hold of you. And one of the reasons why Judah is going to go is because there were Baals all over the place. The world had got hold of them in many, many ways. That's one reason why they're going to go. The other one was that there was the name of the Kemarims with the priests. And the word Kemarim is a Hebrew word which means to be black. And it was, of course, the historians, the archaeologists, who tell us that there were in those days a false priesthood who, because they were false, and Yahweh's priests were dressed in white, they went and dressed in black, just to be opposite. As though they were the black-frocked Kemarim. And they were going to go, brethren and sisters, with the priests. See the point he's making? All right, there was a false priesthood. They said, you dress in white, we'll dress in black. And I suppose the white-frocked priesthood looked back and said, oh, look, they must be wrong, they're dressed in black. Yahweh says, he'll go and you. And he put that in black and white. Them and them would go, brethren and sisters. Not one of them, both of them. And we sometimes say, well, we got the truth and they haven't got the truth. That might be true. But the day of Yahweh's judgment might find us with them because we act like them. Who knows? That's the message of Zephaniah. And then there were those in verse 5 that worship the host of the heaven upon the housetops. And under the law of Moses, they had a standard blueprint for building homes. The 22nd chapter of Deuteronomy, verse 8, said they had to build a house with a flat roof. And they put a battlement around the roof because if you're going to go on top of the house to walk on this flat rooftop, then there was danger of you, of course, spilling over the edge. So they put a battlement around, a guardrail, if you like, so the people could go up on top of the houses. What for? Why would God make them build a house like that? Because when he gave the description, brethren and sisters, in Exodus 30 of the altar of incense, if you look at it in your leisure, you'll find that the Hebrew words for top and sides, in the margin it says, roof and walls. Roof and walls of the altar of incense. Every house in Israel was a copy of that altar of incense. Because the altar of incense had a flat top, it had a table, and a battlement around it. And that was a standard model for every house in Israel. Every house in Israel had to be a house of prayer for Yahweh. And that's why they had the flat roof, so that men could go up the outside staircase, onto the top of the roof, all their women, and there in solitude pray to God. And here they were up there, having a glorious party on the base of the signs of the zodiac. They were all mixed up in superstition. I sincerely hope there would never be a sister who would ever pick up a Woman's Weekly or a Brother or any of those idiotic magazines where they talk about the signs of the zodiac. Oh my goodness. Surely we would never take notice of that. And yet, you know, sometimes you wonder. But people of very low wit could read that and think, oh, I'm such and such a sign. Look what's going to happen to me this month. Of course, the next magazine says something else different, and the next one says something else different, but that's what these idiots were doing. They were up there worshipping the host of heaven. And they were in the place, brethren and sisters, where they should have been praying in solitude to God. No wonder judgment's coming upon Judah. And they did that at night, and in the daytime they're down in the temple singing, "The temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh are we." And that was the days of Zephaniah. Then there were those who were absolutely, blatantly hypocritical. They were swearing by Yahweh and swearing by Malcolm, or Molech, as the word should be. So they were swearing by Yahweh and swearing by Molech. And Yahweh said, "Give me your children for Nazarites." And Molech says, "Feed them into my mouth and I'll sizzle them alive." Molech was a hollow image down in the valley of Hinnom. And they'd light a fire under him and get him glowing white hot. And they'd feed their children into his mouth, or put their children in the palms of his hands, and he'd sizzle them alive. And there were men in the ecclesia who said, "We will give our children to Yahweh and we'll give them to Molech." And there are still men in the ecclesia like that. And if you want me to give you a graphic illustration, you can bring your children to the Sunday school here and the teachers will be absolutely dedicated into getting their little minds to love God. And you will send them to our cursed institutions of education and I'll tell them that there's no God. And anyone who pushes their child past the unreasonable barriers of education deserves everything that comes upon them. And if you want witnesses to that, come to me sometime and I'll give you a list of names of kids that are absolutely driven out of the truth, because the first principle of that place is thou shalt believe nothing. And we see that happening today. It's happening, all right. We swear by Yahweh and we swear by Molech. We instruct our kids with the truth and we put them in a situation that sizzles them alive. And there were people who were doing that. It's still as true today, brothers and sisters, as it was then. And then in verse 6, there were those that had turned back from Yahweh. There were those that hadn't sought him, nor inquired of him. And if you want to put that in modern parlance, there were those who left the truth. There were those who had given up study. And there were those who had given up prayer. They turned back. They weren't seeking him, or they didn't inquire of him. They'd either left the truth, or they'd given up Bible study, or they'd given up praying. That's what they'd done. And Yahweh says, "Hold your peace," in verse 7. He calls them to silence and tells them they're going to be made a sacrifice. And then in verse 9, there were another class, or verse 8, there were another class. Down at the end of verse 8, we were clothed in strange apparel. They were going to go too. All such as are clothed with strange apparel. The word strange in the Hebrew is a word which means foreign. Why was it foreign? Because there was also a standard dress in the nation. Israel were told, they weren't told exactly to make all their clothes exactly the same, but they did have this in common, that around the base of their garments, as the 15th chapter of Numbers verse 35 says, they had a ribbon of blue, a border of blue that swirled around their feet. And they were told what it meant. They weren't left in any doubt as to what that meant, that they might remember all the commandments of Yahweh their God. They'd look up at the vault of heaven, blue in all its blueness, and they'd look at their feet, high above and all around them, were the commandments of Yahweh, and they walked within the ambit of those commandments. And the next verse says, not Zephaniah, I'm talking about Numbers, lest ye go a-whoring after the sight of your eyes. And you look at some garments that people wear, and they dress with sobriety, and dignity and decorum, and you say there's a sister or a brother in the truth whose the truth means something to them. They've obviously got themselves disciplined. They're not going to be flamboyant. They're going to dress in a sober manner, and they impress you. And there are others you think, wow. It all depends, isn't it, how they're dressed. Whether their minds are on the commandments of Yahweh or we go a-whoring after the sight of our eyes. And there were those in Israel, brethren and sisters, who had foreign apparel. And you see it in young people, especially in young people today. Especially in young people today. And a young fella come to me, not in this state, he came to me and he said, "Look, what was the difference between our young people? Why couldn't we all mix together? Why couldn't people from those ecclesias and people from this ecclesias mix together?" I said, "Because it's too dangerous." He couldn't understand that. He said, "How do you know?" I said, "You keep bringing them along, I'll separate them." "You couldn't do that." He said, "You ought to have seen him. You ought to have seen him in that meeting. He stood out like a lighthouse." No, that's clean. He stood out like something else. You ought to see him. And it was obvious that he was different from everybody else just by the way he was dressed. And the mark of the world, brothers and sisters, was from head to toe. And he couldn't understand the difference. And the mind is like that body, like the dress. It's just like that. And when you hear people telling you that the Bible teaches that it doesn't matter what you wear, that is garbage. I will show you piles of scripture to the contrary. When the scripture speaks about the non-importance of clothing, it's dealing with those who dressed up flashily to impress. That's what it's doing. But it doesn't give anyone the right to come in that door looking like they've been dragged through a bush backwards. And there were those in that land that were stood out. How would Zephaniah know who had foreign apparel on? If he didn't know, why would he say it? Of course he'd say, you've got it on. You've got it on. And when the day of Yahweh's anger came, everyone that was dressed like that went, brothers and sisters. Because the mark of the world was on them. That's what it is saying. Verse 9, there was robbery with violence. And in verse 9, servants were robbing their masters' houses. What an age it was. And there was a graphic end to all that, brethren and sisters. You know, the prophets were glorious. The way they captured the drama of an occasion. You listen to this. The day of judgment would come in verse 10. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith Yahweh, that there shall be a noise of a cry from the fish gate, a howling from the second, a great crashing from the hills. Howl, ye inhabitants of Maktesh, for all the merchant people are cut down, all that bear silver are cut off. Now what he's saying is showing us very graphically, brethren and sisters, the mighty inundation of Babylon when it would come upon Jerusalem, and the day when those impregnable walls would come down, and against everyone's belief that nothing would wrong with it could ever happen to Judah, against the belief that they were immune from the judgments of God, there would come an almighty shriek, as the word means. A shriek from the fish gate. Then you hear, in come to the second, it is called, the middle of the city. And then there'd be a crash from the hills, and he'd be through the western wall, the southern wall rather, and into the marketplace, which Maktesh means. And here's the picture of Zephaniah, as he describes the crashing of those walls by the Babylonians. All happened so quickly, brothers and sisters. The day of Yahweh. He describes it in verses 15 and 16. A day of wrath, trouble, distress, wasteness, desolation, darkness, gloominess, clouds and thick clouds. Now the fish gate was in the northern wall of Jerusalem. That's looking north, of course. The fish gate was in the northern wall, so called because it was near the city, nearest to the city of Tyre. And coming down from the north, the Tyrians who brought their fish from the sea would bring it through that gate. And that's where it got its name, the fish gate. The second means the second city, or the middle of the city, which was just in the Tyropean Valley. Just west of the hills of Zion and Moriah. And of course, Maktesh was outside the southern wall, a hollow place here, which is the marketplace. And Zephaniah describes the Babylonian coming. Shriek! The fish gate. He's here! And before they could do anything about it, walked into the middle of the city, and they all dashed out the bottom of the gate to grab their possessions. They were caught, brothers and sisters, in the valley of Hinnom, the whole lot of them. And that's what happened. It may not have been exactly that way when Nebuchadnezzar came and breached the walls, but that was the prophet's graphic description of the end of all those people who put their trust in material possessions, because that's what they were doing. You see, he says in verse 12, or verse 11 again, "Howl, ye inhabitants of the market, for all the merchant people," and the word merchant means Canaanites, "all those who are dabbling in the stock exchange," the Canaanites, "all those who are piling up silver for the last day were cut down." Why? Because they stuffed their pockets full of it, brothers and sisters. Someone said, "Hey, he's a fish, he's at the fish gate." Oh, rushed inside, down all the silver, and they were weighted down in there, out the southern gate, through the market. And the Babylonian, whap, 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 three great strides, and he had the lot of them. Why? Because they couldn't run. They were absolutely weighted down with all their possessions. James quotes that, you know. "How, ye rich men," he says, "ye have heaped up treasure in the last days." You've heaped up treasure in the last days. You know, we mightn't rush to the bank, brethren and sisters, when the angel says, "Come with me to Sinai." We mightn't rush down to our bank manager and say, "Look, give me a ton of gold coins." We mightn't do that. But we might find that our hearts weigh down, mightn't we? We might find it very heavy. Like that young man that left the Lord, his heart was heavy if he had great possessions. And there they were. And all those with material possessions, brethren and sisters, found them in the day of wrath were a liability, not an asset. As the proverb says in the 11th proverb in verse 4, riches profit not in the day of wrath, neither they do. And there is another class too in the ecclesia then, in verse 12, that Yahweh was going to search with candles, because they may not get caught out here. They may not be the merchant class. They're not the class probably in the ecclesia that's got a lot of money, but they were another class, and they were buried. They were hidden away, as they always are. And they're going to be searched out with candles. Who are they? Well, they're the men settled on their lees. They're the fellows that say in their heart, Yahweh will not do any good, neither will he do any evil. And they're the class in the ecclesia that's very comfortable at home. You talk about a special, and they say, oh, special if it's nothing, you know, not everything. Not everything. Not everything in the ecclesia. It's what you do, you know, what you do with your life that counts. I don't want to be at the meeting. And they settle down a bit closer in their chair. And you talk about Yahweh's judgments. Oh, I don't think Christ will come for a few years yet. They say that Yahweh will do no good, and they say that Yahweh will do no evil. The ecclesia is full of them, brothers and sisters. Look, it's absolutely pathetic when you hear some of the things that are said, and there are people settling deeper and deeper and deeper on their lees. You know what they do with wine? They let it settle on its lees until there's body and colour in that wine, and then they pour it off. Or as Jeremiah the prophet said about Moab, sometimes they turn the cask upside down in order that the lees again might sift through the liquid. And he pointed out that Moab, along with Judah, hadn't been turned for years, and they'd got to a syrupy stage. A great big syrupy stage and jellified when they weren't going to do any good or any evil. No, the ecclesia couldn't help them, and they didn't think that Christ would come anyway. And that's what their attitude is. And Yahweh, they mightn't be at Maktesh, they'll be underneath the floorboard somewhere, down in the cellars, in their comfortable holes, but Yahweh will search them out with a candle. How'd you like to be in the dark and a candle light your face up? Gotcha. You're the one who said, oh, no good doing this or doing that, poured cold water on any enthusiasm. And when the judgments of God were spoken of, you're the one that said, oh, I've only got a few more years yet. I don't really think that Christ will do this or do that. Won't he? One of these days, brothers and sisters, there's going to be an almighty shriek, a huge explosion in the centre of the earth, and all the merchant people swept up by the hand of Yahweh. Gone. And that day is coming. Oh boy, is it ever coming. Look, in verse 14, for example, what does he say? The great day of Yahweh, you leave out the words in italics, near, and speeding along, as the Hebrew has it. And there's the prophet watching it come. And he gives two figures later on, brethren and sisters, of this day of Yahweh speeding along, as if he was watching it coming and saying, the day of Yahweh near, and speeding along, is the expression of the Hebrew. And they didn't think it was at all. But it was, you know. Just come away from Zephaniah just for once, the 2nd of Peter chapter 3, because he picks up those words. Peter quotes them. And it's important, brethren and sisters, to see what context he quotes them in. See how the Bible complements the Bible here. Look at the context of these words. And here's the words of Zephaniah the prophet. How wonderful is this book. Peter talks about the dissolving of the Jewish Commonwealth in AD 70. But his words are equally true of our day, brethren and sisters. And in verse 11 he says, of his second epistle chapter 3 in verse 11, seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and speeding along? The margin says, hasting the coming of the day of God. And Peter talks about things being dissolved. You ever seen a thing dissolved? You drop a Bex or something in a glass of water and watch it. It dissolves. God. And all these things, he said, which we see today, which constitute not only the Jewish heaven and the earth, but the heaven and earth of this world, brothers and sisters, dissolved. And there will be those who are looking for the day of Yahweh speeding along. Now, the difference between Peter and Zephaniah is they weren't looking for it, and it was speeding along. And there are people whose hearts are yearning for that day to come. There are hearts in our ecclesia today, brothers and sisters, that yearn for that coming more than yours and mine do. And that's one of the great benefits of trouble and trial and illness and sickness. There's a great benefit in all that. And I think we've learned our lesson about that. I don't think anyone's going to get any relief. But I do think we're all going to learn a lesson. And there's going to be some of us, brothers and sisters, in this ecclesia, some of us who are going to go to that judgment seat with yearning hearts and are blessed. And I don't mean that facetiously, I mean it sincerely. They are blessed in their illnesses, because that's what it does for their hearts. And they are speeding that day along more than you and I could ever realize. And that's what Peter said. There were those people who were speeding that day along, and there were those who were standing in the path of it who didn't know it was speeding along. But it is speeding along, and that's the message of Zephaniah. When we come back to that prophet, he has something to say about that day, brothers and sisters. You know, in a few words, the prophet can gather up the great aura of the age. He can show the drama in very few words. And in verse 14 again, Zephaniah says, the great day of Yahweh, near, near, speeding along. And then in the Hebrew, we've got an exclamation. It says, hark to the voice of the day of Yahweh. Listen. So we'll all listen. What is it? What would be the voice of the day of Yahweh? Well, he says, the mighty man shall cry there bitterly. That's the voice of the day, brothers and sisters. Listen to what he's saying. A mighty man. The word is Gibor. He's a real strong man. And as everybody quietens down, hold thy peace, verse 7 says, at the presence of Adonai Yahweh. Now says Zephaniah, listen to what the voice is saying. And everybody gets quiet, and all you hear is the voice of someone crying. It's not a child. It's not a woman. It's not even a man, brothers and sisters. It's a very strong man. And if there's anything more alarming and frustrating is when strong men cry. And you can imagine Israel putting their trust in their army and in their generals and in their heroes. And Yahweh says, listen. And you hear a deep voice sobbing in bitter frustration. There's nobody can help them. That's the voice of the day, brothers and sisters. When leaders break down, that's the end. And the mighty man cries there bitterly. And we talk about the day of Yahweh, we say, oh, we hope Christ comes soon. It's a day of wrath. Oh, I wish Christ would come this year. It's a day of trouble. And we go on and we say this or that. It's a day of distress. Desolation, wasteness, gloominess, clouds and thick darkness. It is for evil people. And we could mouth all the platitudes about the coming of Christ, brothers and sisters, but it'll come upon us as a pall of gloom unless we are in that way that Zephaniah later on speaks about. But if we're not, then all our flowery language of how we love the coming of Christ will be but dust in our teeth, brothers and sisters, in the day when the gloom of that day settles over us. Would you really, honestly, be thrilled if an angel came through that door tonight and said, Christ is here? Would you be honestly thrilled? Would you really? Well, we've got to haste the day of Yahweh if we want that day. And if we don't want it, brothers and sisters, it is hasting anyway. That's what Zephaniah and that's what Peter say. And we've got to be very careful about that. The day of their expectations didn't turn out to be what they thought it was. Now in chapter 2, he opens up these words, this chapter, with the words, gather yourselves together. Yea, gather together, O nation not desired. Now he's talking about Judah, of course, and they're not desired. They thought they were. They were all rushing up to the temple and they thought that God desired them. But they were not desired. And he tells them to gather themselves together. Now there's a rather peculiar structure to the Hebrew here, so says the experts, and there's been many and varied translations of Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 1. But the notable Hebraist, Gesenius, says that the words merely mean to gather your thoughts together. And that's exactly how Abraham translates it. Collect your thoughts. Now let's collect our thoughts. Here's the day of Yahweh and it's rushing up on us. Let's stop, brothers and sisters, and collect our thoughts. There are three things to think about. You listen to them. Before the decree bring forth, before the day passes, and the day passes chaff. Before the fierce anger of Yahweh come upon you, before the day of Yahweh's anger come upon you. Now in the middle you've got the day of his fierce anger. The word there indicates an anger that is glowing but has not yet ignited into flame. But the final expression is the day of Yahweh's anger means to burst into flame. So we've got to think about something. The thing is this, before the decree bring forth and the day passes chaff, before Yahweh's anger, while it's growing to white heat, before it bursts into flame, think about something. What are we going to think about? Well, seek Yahweh. Seek righteousness and seek meekness. Now there's nothing very, very detailed about that message, brothers and sisters. And when the Word of God says collect your thoughts, Very simple. There's your three things. There's your three warnings. And there's only three things to do. Before the day the decree bring forth, the day passes chaff, before Yahweh's anger bursts into flame, before that day actually comes, seek Yahweh, seek righteousness, seek meekness. Very simple. Nothing very profound about that. Or not very profound about it. Nothing very difficult about that, is there? And there's your message. Collect your thoughts, brothers and sisters, because that's what we've got to do. Seek Yahweh. There's only one way you can do that, like Josiah did. Seek Yahweh, the God of his father David. Seek his righteousness. And when one seeks Yahweh's righteousness, we are terribly humbled. That's the message of today. Anyone doing that won't be caught with silver in their pockets in the marketplace. They'll be hidden in the day of Yahweh's anger. That was the message of the prophet, brothers and sisters. A wonderful message. But look at the figures here. Look at these two figures. Before the decree bring forth. And the word is for childbirth. So God has issued a decree. He issued it back in the days of Manasseh. In the days of Manasseh, the judgment of God was conceived. And the judgment was conceived way back 57 years before Josiah. Now we're up 70-odd years in his reformation. 70 years previously, the day of Yahweh was conceived. And now the whole city is pregnant with judgment. And there's nothing can stop it. When conception takes place, inexorably it grows, brothers and sisters, to that end day. And Paul used that figure in 1 Thessalonians 5. As he talked about the day would come upon them as the woman in travail. Before the day passes the chaff. Oh, did Israel know anything about that? Did they ever? They're very messy with threshing, brothers and sisters. A pile of sheaves and a floor, and they'd get their oxen to go round and round and round, and the hooves of the oxen would thresh it all in pieces. Then they'd get their forks, and they'd put it in the heap of hay and wheat, and they'd hurl it into the air, and the summer winds, the most steadiest winds Israel knows, which blow from the northwest, clear across the tip of Carmel on that angle, right down the angle of Carmel across that land, brethren and sisters, the steadiest wind known in Israel comes in the harvest time, and up goes the chaff, and zoom, along goes the chaff in that wind, steadily blowing out of existence. And everyone knew that figure. It was seen by every man, woman and child all over that land. Chaff flying along in the wind. And that's what's happening with the day of Yahweh, brethren and sisters. It's flying along in the wind. The steadiest wind that ever blew is the wind of God's Spirit and his prophets. And it's flying along in that wind. Oh boy, they knew that figure. And so these things were told them to collect their thoughts. Now from chapter 4 verse 15, we have a section in which the prophet deals with nations. Because you know the prophets didn't only deal with the people of Israel and Judah, but they sometimes singled out nations for their judgments. And of course, Zephaniah in his first chapter had said that. He said in verse 3, I will consume man and beast, fowls of the heaven, fishes of the sea, and the stumbling blocks with the wicked, and I will cut off man from the land, saith Yahweh. And so he deals now, brethren and sisters, with all those nations which surrounded Israel. And judgment would come upon them too, because Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, would reap the harvest of the whole Middle East as Yahweh's servant. So he deals with the Philistines. I don't intend to deal with this in detail, but I want to show you, brethren and sisters, some of the poetic structure of these judgments. As I said, the prophets, the Hebrew prophets were poets. And in putting their things in poetic structure, it made them stand up and be seen as important. So he singles out verses 4 to 7, the Philistines. And he says that Gaza shall be forsaken and Ashkelon a desolation. You know, just taking a couple of examples, Gaza in the Hebrew is Azar. And the word forsaken is Azubar. Almost the same construction. Azar is Azubar. So the strong Azar will be desolate, says the prophet. Ashkelon, he says, he will make a desolation. Now Ashkelon, brothers and sisters, was the Philistine merchant city. It was the capital, or the commercial capital, of the Philistines. It was Rundle Mall. And you find the expression used several times in the scripture of the streets of Ashkelon, where everybody went to do their shopping. A desolation, said the prophet. At the end of verse 4, Ekron shall be rooted up. And Ekron means to be rooted up. The city which means to be rooted up shall be rooted up, he said. And so you find the poetic structure that continues. You come down to verse 8 to verses 11, brothers and sisters. And he talks about Moab and the children of Ammon. I have heard the reproach of Moab and the revilings of the children of Ammon, whereby they have reproached my people and magnified themselves against their border. Therefore, as I live, saith Yahweh of armies, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be as Sodom, and the children of Ammon as Gomorrah. What's poetic about that? Brethren and sisters, let me tell you something about Moab and Ammon. And you already know it, but perhaps you just need me to point it out to you. If ever there were two nations on God's earth who should have known what the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was about, they should have. Moab is a word which means from father, and Ammon has the connotation of inbred. And Moab and Ammon were two boys born to the daughters of Lot by the incestuous union with their father, right under the shadow of the Holocaust of Sodom and Gomorrah. If ever there were two nations who ought to know what that means, they ought to. Their very descendants were conceived right under that shadow of that Holocaust. Tremendous, isn't it, brethren and sisters? Ethiopia is mentioned in verse 12, very briefly. Why is it briefly? Because I believe that the Ethiopians are only here mentioned in conjunction with the Assyrians as representing the extreme south and the extreme north. And the Ethiopians don't come in for a lengthy judgment here, brothers and sisters, but the Assyrians do. And he talks about the Assyrian and Nineveh in verse 13. And the description that Zephaniah gives in verse 14 is a wild beast roaming the ruins, birds perched up in the broken down littles and the trusses of the roof, where all the roof is falling, and there's birds singing up in the roof. There's an exultant city which is a dreary wilderness, because he says in verse 15, this is the rejoicing city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I, leave out the words am, because it's not there, I. And this great city of Assyria, brethren and sisters, has dominated north of Babylon, which dominated that region in former days and was still a great power. I. They said that in their heart. They didn't say that to be shown off to men. They believed it. Said it in their heart. I. And dwelt very carelessly. And Nineveh, brethren and sisters, was to go and become a desolate ruin. That was the judgment upon those nations. But now he returns in chapter 3 to Judah. And what about what he says about Judah? Woe to her that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city. In other words, brothers and sisters, whilst the world is bad, if the ecclesia goes the way of the world, it's worse, because they know better. And you know, you look at those terms of contempt that he uses of Judah. See the poetic nature of that. You see, who is more filthy than the Philistines? Who is more polluted in the conception of their nation than Moab and Ammon? And who is more oppressive than the Assyrian? And Zephaniah turns from those three nations, having indicted them, and says, but look at you. Have a look at your condition. You're like the Philistines, you're like Moab and Ammon, and you're like Assyria. Never mind about the world, says Zephaniah. God will take care of them. What about you? You know better. And why were they like that, brethren and sisters? You read with me why they were like it. Here's the cause and effect. Verse 2 of chapter 3. She obeyed not the voice. She received not correction. She trusted not in Yahweh and drew not near to her God. And you might say to yourself, well, why did the ecclesia do that? Well, her princes within her are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves. Verse 4, her prophets are light and treacherous persons, and her priests have polluted the sanctuary and have done violence to the law. You look at that in a poetic structure. This is why the ecclesia fails, brethren and sisters. This is why they fail. You look at the way this is structured. They didn't obey the voice. Why didn't they obey the voice of their rulers? Because their rulers weren't worth obeying. They didn't receive any correction. There was no justice. Why? Because the judiciary was stank with corruption. They didn't trust in Yahweh. Why didn't they trust in Yahweh? Because their prophets were light and treacherous persons. They didn't draw near to their God. Why didn't they draw near to their God? Because their priests had done violence to the law. Can't you see cause and effect in all that? Why don't we obey the voice of our king, brothers and sisters, today? Why don't we obey the voice of our king? Because those of the ecclesia in many parts who are entrusted with the care of his ecclesia go about their own way like roaring lions. They couldn't care less about others. They just roar around like lions. A lion's out the filly's stomach and to heck with the rest. Well, no one's going to follow ecclesial rule, ecclesial guidance. No one's going to keep decorum if the rulers don't care a rush. Why would people deal unjustly with one another when there are absolute travesties of justice in the ecclesia? Why would the ecclesia be people who deal justly one with the other if the people who lead them can't do that way? And why don't our people trust in Yahweh? When you've got every man Jack has got his opinion about the apocalypse. You don't believe me? Brethren and sisters, I have stood in Bible schools where there have been 60 to 100 people gathering around me and Werner who have been weeping, crying their eyes out because they say, John, we are confused. That's why. Why don't our people trust in Yahweh? Because they're absolutely confused because the prophets are light and treacherous persons. They don't know what to believe. One says this, one says that, one says this. And those poor people don't know where they're going. And so you find they don't trust in Yahweh. And there's your reason. And why don't we draw near to our God? Because of those who lead us in our prayers, who lead us in our worship, who do violence to the law, where can you follow their example? And so you find that structure. There's your reason. There's your cause. There's your effect. It's tremendous, brethren and sisters. Look at the tremendous responsibility that rests upon brethren and sisters who are given the responsibility to lead, not so much with the sisters in an official capacity, but sisters do lead. They lead by their example. And the brethren do lead by their example and in their official capacity. And if those people are not going to give a lead, then you're going to have cause and effect. That's what Zephaniah said. Obeying princes, receiving judgment from judges, trusting because of the prophets and drawing near through priests. There's your structure. And if it doesn't start at the top, all the bottom will break down. And such is the prophecy of Zephaniah at that point. But it doesn't finish like that, brethren and sisters. Zephaniah finishes on an exciting note. It really does. And in chapter 3, in verse 8, there are wonderful words. You know, three times you get in verse 8, the day of Yahweh. Verse 11, in that day. In verse 16, in that day. And the last section, brethren and sisters, deals with that day. And what is the message for today in verse 8? Wait upon me. And you know, that's what we do as Christadelphians. So we don't enter in, brethren and sisters, with the organizations of this world. We don't enter into peace relationships with people. We don't go to peace rallies. We don't go to peace conventions or anything like that. We don't join with the uniting church in trying to bring charitable things to bear upon the world that we might convert the world. Because we know we won't convert the world. All we're told to do is wait upon me. And in our waiting, we try and draw whoever we can from that holocaust into the shadow of God's protection that they might be hidden in the day of his wrath. We can do no more than that, brethren and sisters. And what's he going to do? He says, in the day that I rise up to the prey. Now that's very badly translated actually. The word pray really means to witness. In the day, says Yahweh, when I will rise up to witness. And he says, for my determination is. And the word determination, brethren and sisters, in the Hebrew is a word you might recognize, mishpat, which is the word that's very often rendered judgment, which really means to make a decision, a verdict. So Yahweh says, wait. All the injustices. People are not obeying the voice of their rulers. People are not receiving justice. People don't trust in Yahweh. People don't draw near to God. And Josiah couldn't change them, brethren and sisters. Zephaniah couldn't change them. Jeremiah couldn't change them. And God said to all those faithful men, wait. Just wait. Because there's a day coming, he said, when I will rise up as a witness and I will give my verdict. And that'll be a day, won't it, brothers and sisters? You think of all the ecclesial squabbles, of all our petty arguments, of all the little hatreds and envies and bitterness, till the witness stands up and says, this is my verdict. Wait for that day. Don't try and avenge yourself. Don't try and justify yourself. Just wait. Because he'll stand up and there'll be a witness. And his determination is to gather the nations, assemble the kingdoms, pour out upon them the fire of his jealousy, and verse 9, he'll turn to them a pure language. In a word, brethren and sisters, he will reverse the principles of the Tower of Babel. Because they gathered the nations, didn't they? They gathered the nations, they called the people, and they built a tower that they might have unity, and he scattered them. But he's going to reverse all that. He's going to bring them together, burn out of them all that's trivial, unite them together, and give them a pure language, and we'll go right back past the Tower of Babel. And you know, there's nothing more uniting for nations than to speak a common tongue. We look back through the history of world wars as to who it is that's formed alliances. It's people whose tongues are similar or near to similar. Nothing more uniting than for people to speak a common tongue. The word, the margin says, lip. A common lip. Not only so, he said, but they shall call upon the name of Yahweh to serve him with one consent. And the margin says for the word consent, and it rightly says it, shoulder. Can you imagine what that means? So two things are mentioned. What the voice says and what the shoulder does. So Yahweh assembles the kingdoms together. He blasts out of all that's evil. He gets them all to speak one language, and they all put their shoulder to the wheel. And in a common way, in a common bond, they work together for good. As the word shoulder is often used in the sense of shouldering one's responsibilities, working for the truth, and so speaking a common language, serving a common cause. The day of Yahweh's anger is coming, but beyond that, brothers and sisters, there is glory. Verses 11 to 13 tell us that he'll save a humble remnant of Israel. Verse 12, I will also leave in the midst of thee an afflicted and a poor people, and they shall trust in the name of Yahweh, and one of them was Josiah. Because you are tender-hearted, and you have humbled yourself in the sight of God, I will leave in thee a poor and an afflicted people. Not all Israel shall be saved, brothers and sisters, not every Jew, but some of them will, and the nation will survive. And he goes on from verses 14 onwards to talk about the wonder of the day of Yahweh. And you know, if we had enough time, I'd like to take you through this section, brethren and sisters, Hebrew word by Hebrew word by Hebrew word, because you've never seen such a collection of words as Zephaniah uses here to try and to stimulate our enthusiasm for the kingdom with the words that he uses. Sing, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Be glad and rejoice with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. Zion, the spiritual center of the kingdom, brethren and sisters. Israel, the nation. The daughter of Jerusalem, the politics of that age. The kingdom of God upon the earth. Spiritual Israel, natural Israel, and the kingdom, the daughter of Jerusalem. And they're singing and shouting their heart out on that day. Why? Three reasons in verse 15. Yahweh has set aside thy judgments. That's reason number one. Reason number two, he has cast out thine enemy. And the third reason is, Yahweh is in the midst of thee. There are three good reasons, brethren and sisters, to get excited, aren't they? But Israel will realize in that day that they have suffered dreadfully over the years and in the battle of Armageddon. Finally, Yahweh will set aside their judgment. It will be over. The enemy is gone, and Yahweh is in the midst of them. Who is he? Who is this one that represents Yahweh, brethren and sisters? Look at verse 17. Yahweh thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. And they'll say, what's his name? And they'll say, Jesus. Yahushua. Yahweh will save. That's who's in the midst of them. What a thrill. What a thrill for all of us. He is in the midst of them. And what will it be like in that day, brethren and sisters? Look at the end of verse 17. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. You know, if you were to translate those Hebrew words, what you find is this. First of all, the word rejoice over thee with joy, the word means to be bright and glad. There's a gladness and a brightness about the presence of that king, and he and they who are around him will rejoice. And then all of a sudden, the prophet introduces this note, he will rest in his love. Now the margin says he will be silent. And it's right. So the one who's rejoicing with them also has a silent yearning for them, as they've had for him. Unutterable yearnings, brothers and sisters. So you find the prophet speaking about a joy and a gladness and a silence when words are inadequate to express the unutterable yearning of people's hearts to be together in the kingdom with him. And then he says he will joy over them with singing. And this time the word joy is a Hebrew word which means to spin around in ecstasy. And of course the Jews were demonstrative people. We wouldn't do that these days. We'd be the laughing stock of the place. But they were demonstrative people. Jesus himself was a demonstrative person. He wasn't beyond crying in public. He wasn't beyond weeping in the Garden of Gethsemane, brothers and sisters. He wasn't beyond putting little children on his lap. He wasn't beyond showing his feelings to people. And in the age to come, there will be greater reason than ever before to show our feelings together. There will be the great rejoicing. There will be the silent moments when we just can't express anything that is in our heart is so full of that longing and that yearning which is now fulfilled. And when that passes, we will spin in joy while we sing. That's the words of Zephaniah the prophet. And I will gather them, he says in verse 18, that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly, who are of thee, to whom the approach of it was a burden. Very difficult translation, you'll notice, by all the words in italics. But I believe it's very clear what that's saying. That those people in the kingdom will be those people who went through a time of great sorrow for what had been lost, and really felt the reproach that fell upon the truth because people apostatized. You think about that. That note is introduced there, brothers and sisters, to show that who it is in the kingdom will sing and dance. Blessed are they that mourn, for Jesus said they will rejoice. You see, there are sorrowful people around today. Why are they sorrowful? Because the solemn assemblies are going. The days of solemnity, brethren and sisters, of dignity, of respect for one another, of loveliness, are going. Permit me to introduce a little personal note here at this moment, brethren and sisters. The only time I have ever seen Brother Mansfield cry was at the grave of my father-in-law, Brother Wigsall. I've never seen him shed a tear until that day. And he saw me and he'd come across to me, and I try to comfort him, and he says, I'm not weeping for Wilbur John, he said. He said, I'm weeping for the end of a generation. And I knew exactly what he meant. I will gather them that are sorrowful for the solemn assembly. All of them who see the reproach that is coming upon the truth because of indignity and disrespect feel that as a burden. There are dozens of people like that, especially old people. They really feel that, brothers and sisters, to see the standards dropping, the name of Christadelphia no longer honoured, and looseness and all that thing creeping into the ecclesia. They're sorrowful. They're going to be in God's kingdom, because all those things will be restored. That's what Zephaniah is saying. And when he speaks about the gathering of Israel, and where have you heard these words before? Verse 19, behold, at that time I will undo all that afflict thee, and I will save her that halteth, and gather her that is driven out. They are the words of Micah chapter 4, aren't they? He's here. Way up in history here in the days of Josiah. But remember Micah? I will gather her that is halted and her that I have driven out. And the prophet's words are being echoed from prophet to prophet to prophet. Not a lot. Jeremiah quotes Hosea at length. But the other prophets every now and then echo one another's words down the corridor of history. I will gather her that halteth, and her that I have driven out, are the exact expressions of Micah chapter 4. And he speaks of the regathering of Israel. And he says, at that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you. For I will make you a name and a praise among all the people of the earth when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith Yahweh. So ends the words, brothers and sisters, of Zephaniah the prophet. Let us heed his message. A day of Yahweh near. All brethren and sisters near and speeding along.